So how does one start a podcast?
Usually with witty banter.
Witty banter.
And thoughtful, introspective introductions.
Introductions, okay.
The Popstorian Podcast with Chris and Ben.
Wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet.
Greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market.
A date which will live in infamy.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Might have gotten away with it, too. Wasn't for
these blasted kids and their dogs. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The evil of the thriller.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you.
Great power comes great responsibility.
Popstorian is an attempt to study pop culture history.
Where pop culture and history meet. I'm Ben. And my connection to Popstorian is more the popular culture end. I'm a movie buff, aficionado, and work in the film industry on a small scale.
And I am Chris, amateur historian.
Well, can we really say amateur?
Well, I've had like 3 years in museums giving tours and the like. Uh-huh. But no really original research, so
let's just say scholar of history,
student of history.
There we go. That makes you sound more grandiose.
Student or scholar?
Scholar, but student works too.
Oh, student of history.
Student of history, and student of history implies that you're also learning from history too.
Yeah,
I feel.
Which I think is something we all should do.
Yeah, exactly. So, Chris, the student of history, Ben, the movie buff. This is the Popstorian podcast. Why did we decide to do a podcast?
Why did we decide to do a podcast? Because we've been trying to work out some original content for Popstorian for about 3 years.
It has been 3 years. Good heavens.
We've had Facebook and Twitter page up for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. An excellent source of information about pop culture history, as well as new developments in pop culture history world.
We try anyway.
Yes, you do an excellent job. So this particular episode marks the debut of a series we want to do called Westerns by the Decade. And it's an attempt to examine the history of the American Western in the cinema.
Westerns by the Decade.
Starting with the 1900s all the way probably to the 2010s, I think we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That should give us a good 12 or 13 episodes to work on.
We'll get a couple out of that. Let's talk about Westerns by the Decade. Why Westerns? What's so enduring about this art form that started years and years ago and now continues to this very day from generation to generation in American popular culture?
It kind of tells us where we've come from. Anyways, I think Frederick Jackson Turner, historian in the late part of the 19th century, wrote a paper about how the West was, that's kind of the progress of American, what it meant to be American, was the West and the frontier. And he's typically cited in talking about history of the West, although his ideas are somewhat outdated now. But the basic idea of that's what it means to be American, because I think the West is probably the closest thing America has to a mythos.
The great American mythology.
Yeah. And even many of our historical figures from the West are kind of myths in American cinema. Kind of makes that much more so. It's our fairy tales.
Yeah, and that idea of exploration, of foraging off into the unknown, is such a important part of America as we know it. Because we're all immigrants here. We're all people who came from, most of us, from European ancestry or from other parts of the world.
Yeah, I guess even going back to the early 19th century, you talk about Manifest Destiny and constantly pushing forward. Mm-hmm. You believe that literally ordained by God to go all the way across the continent.
Yeah. So
the West has always been part of American culture, even from the very beginning.
Yeah, which I think is remarkable, because you think about people on holy missions, you typically think about the Crusades and people heading in the other direction, to the east, to the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
But then after Martin Luther, I guess, would be about the time that all that moving westwardly on a mission from God kind of would have started.
It's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, that's what we're here for, Chris, to explore. It's
an interesting thought. At least the idea is, you're right, after the Crusades, Reconquista, the Spanish, were sent Christopher Columbus west. But he's actually trying to go east, but he's going a different direction.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thought. He is sent to Christianize the peoples that he meets. So that is an interesting idea. But a little off topic, actually.
Yeah, sorry. We rambled, as we often do.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what we're getting into here. Westerns by the decade.
So, a little fun bit, at least I had fun doing the context here. The Western has been around for quite some time, as you know it as the genre. Some have given credit to Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, kind of starting that up.
Definitely, yeah.
The Virginian, which is noted Western. I don't know if you ever read The Virginian.
I have not.
I just read that this year. Owen Wister. Yeah, he wrote The Virginian, and it's kind of looked at as one of the first truly Western pieces of literature, kind of like the whole idea of what a Western should be, strong central character and conflict and the like, and what a Western.
Whenabouts was that?
It is published in 1902.
Oh, wow.
So when you look at The Great Train Robbery, which is our film for this week, it was released in 1903.
Yeah. So right up on the heels of that. And I guess Buffalo Bill's Wild West show would have been the 1880s.
1883, if I recall correctly here.
Is when it started?
1883.
So only about 20 years before.
I put this film right in the middle of the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. And these are historical time tools. They really don't have a specific beginning or ending time area. So they kind of mold into each other. But when you think about the Gilded Age, is kind of that time period of the West, what we think of the West. So you think of the Indian Wars, you think of the mining towns, or those classic Western themes. The ranch versus farmer wars, kind of these ideas. That's happening right after the Civil War. So the Civil War ends and everybody, of course, moves out west. And so you have a lot of these films with these kind of themes, what happens after the war.
Yeah,
so
kind of get away from all that conflict.
Right. So the Gilded Age kind of goes from 1866 to 1900. And then the progressive era kind of comes on the heels of that, 1900 to 1920. So this film is taking place kind of right in the middle of that.
And the, I guess the Industrial Revolution kind of spans in between both of those.
Much more so. The Industrial Revolution starts up in the early 19th century, but really, really ramps up in that Gilded Age time period. Yeah. So business is booming. Mm-hmm. It's often notoriously known for corruption. And then the progressive era is supposed to kind of fix some of those social woes.
Yeah. And a lot of that technological advancement would be key to the development of cinema.
Yes, and actually.
Ties pretty directly into this this particular movie that we've chosen to be our first one.
I made some notes about film history here as well, because this is sometimes cited. Actually, I looked this up. Oh, the Guinness Book of World Records claims that The Great Train Robbery is the first fiction film. That is actually controversial. There are one source I have, a Mr. Thompson, who is a film critic, has it actually a film called, and this is my French here, so bear with me, La Assure a Rose.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm familiar with that.
You're familiar with this.
I am.
It's the Lumiere brothers, correct?
Yes, you are quite correct. 1897, I want to say?
1895.
Yeah, it's actually a pun in French.
Yeah.
I forget what it means.
I think...
Something to the effect of a surprise for the gardener.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I looked it up and I did not write it down, so I'm sorry.
Did you get to watch it?
I haven't watched it, actually. No, I read about it, but I didn't actually sit down and watch
it. It's rather short, of course, from 1895. Most of the films from... The very, very beginnings of cinema were short. It consists of a gardener watering his garden, and a small, mischievous boy comes up behind him and steps on the garden hose, causing the flow of the water to cease. And the gardener, wondering what has happened, looks down the nozzle of the garden hose. And at which point, the boy removes his foot from the garden hose, causing the flow of water to resume into the face of the ill-fated gardener.
And there you have it.
And there you have it. A presumably fictional scenario?
It was supposed to be set up. It was not organic, as they say.
Hmm.
The Lumiere
most early films were, just observational.
Yeah, because the Lumieres have made this camera, apparently, and then they sent cameramen all over the world to film oddities. So apparently this was one of those things, and many think that was actually completely set up.
Yeah, the Lumieres were one of the early competitors with Edison for making movies or flickers or motion pictures, whatever you want to call them, whatever term. There was a lot of terms being bandied about. In the early days, each producer had their own terminology for what they were doing, and it wasn't standardized by any means. They were a large competitor with what Edison was doing, and trying to beat him at every turn in terms of making better content, making it more accessible to the public, selling more, making more money. They were very competitive in that way.
Was it head to head, or was it just like, oh, he's doing this thing, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, I think the competition, even though their films would have been screened in some of the same markets, I would imagine, I think the competition was more of a technological comparable to the space race in a sense, where they were creating different things and trying to outdo each other. So they would have been very aware of what the other one was doing in terms of spectacle and the types of films that they were creating. They were both majorly trying to push boundaries. And then around the same time, you have Georges Méliès, a magician from France.
I was actually just going to bring him up here. It's interesting. His film comes out before The Great Train Robbery.
It does. His most famous work, A Trip to the Moon, comes out in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
And he's made some other spectacular movies around the same time period. Most notably, I think, is called The Man with the Rubber Head, which involves a lot of trick photography. Méliès discovers trick photography and special effects by accident. And he's shooting some footage of the street in Paris. I think it was in Paris. And he's rolling and the film camera breaks and jams. And he clears the jam and then starts filming again. And when he starts filming again, the cart that was in front of him has moved and is now a hearse. And when he screens the film back, the cart turns into a hearse in a flash of, you know, from one frame to another.
So is he considered like the father of special effects then?
Definitely, yeah. And one of the great fathers of cinema in many ways too, because he uses film editing in a similar way to Lumiere's and eventually Edison too, in that he starts to use sequences to create action rather than just shooting one wide shot of one event and that being your entire film. He starts to splice together multiple pieces to create an effect. So have you seen A Trip to the Moon?
I've seen parts of it. Of course, I've seen Hugo,
right,
which shows several clips of the film, if not the whole film, actually.
Yeah. It's quite short. I think it's shorter than The Great Train Robbery, because The Great Train Robbery was noted for its length at the time.
And then it's only about 12 minutes long.
It's about 12 minutes long, yeah. So things are happening by the time The Great Train Robbery comes out. Photography has progressed to film. Celluloid is already the standard material used to make films. Movies are still mostly screened in Nickelodeons, machines basically that you would pay a nickel and you get to go in and watch a movie.
Quite a bit of Edison's income right there.
Mm-hmm. Edison is huge in the development of the Nickelodeon.
Mr. Edwin S. Porter is the director of The Great Train Robbery.
Correct.
And from what I've read about him, he seemed kind of like this pioneer kind of a filmmaker as well, but you don't really hear much about him.
No, his name doesn't get thrown around a lot. He's mainly remembered for The Great Train Robbery. It's considered to be his greatest achievement. Obviously, quite a talented figure, and one of many, many figures surrounding Edison to get kind of absorbed into the massive image that was Edison.
That is true. That's true.
Yeah, spectacular movie to start out with. Because it's not only is it the first Western, but it's quite strong as a piece of cinema for its time, especially in comparison with a lot of the other Nickelodeons that were out there.
What other Nickelodeons were been quite popular at the time?
So the movie that they made right before this called Life of an American Fireman.
Right, I've heard of this one, yeah.
Which is also by Edwin S. Porter. That was considered quite revolutionary for using shots on location cut together with studio footage.
This comes out before Great Train Robbery? Because I wasn't sure about the timing.
Yes, it does. They both come out in the same year. The Great Train Robbery comes out in December.
Ah, okay.
In Great Britain, there was a film called Alice in Wonderland that is considered quite significant from a historical perspective. I doubt it would have been seen in America very much. A popular film that Edison made was called Electrocuting an Elephant. That is legitimately a film of an elephant being electrocuted.
I was actually going to bring this up
yeah,
a little later on.
This would have been the same year as well. I actually watched that.
Did you?
I did.
I was tempted to look it up, but then I was like, I don't know if I would want to admit
that. It's a bit macabre. It's not for the highly sensitive or for the animal lover.
The elephant by the name was named Topsy.
Topsy is indeed the figure.
And apparently Topsy had killed someone and they were to be executed.
Yes, indeed. Topsy was executed for the murder of one of her handlers. The historical consensus believes that said individual was not handling Topsy properly. to understate the situation.
Not very nice to Topsy.
No, and Topsy was not very nice in return, but such incidents can turn animals aggressive.
But Topsy was not only electrocuted, she was also injected with poison.
Correct.
And hung.
I believe the plan was to hang her, and Edison suggested execution by electricity because he wanted to discredit all of Edison's electrical systems were DC, direct current.
Right.
And his competitor, George Westinghouse, was the big proponent of AC.
Alternating current.
Alternating current, which is what we use standard today in our household systems. Edison recommended electrocuting the elephant, partially, I think, so he could film it and make a successful film out of it, but also because he wanted to use AC to give it a negative public reputation as a dangerous form of electricity.
Kill your animals.
Right, and just in general be seen as dangerous.
There's an article from Smithsonian Magazine I think I put on the notes there.
Mm-hmm.
So we can give that to our...
Yeah, we can definitely put that in our show notes.
Give that to our audience. That is pop culture as well, right there.
It is. So you're looking at something like that, and then you go to The Great Train Robbery, which, in addition to being a Western, is kind of a blockbuster. It may not seem like it to us today, but it moves quite fast. As the film opens up, it starts with right away into the action, starting in a clerk's office at a train station. And almost immediately, he's accosted by armed robbers who tie him up and hijack his train at the water tower. The movie moves at a pretty good clip, despite its length. It cuts expertly between exteriors and interiors. Not quite seamlessly. I think by today's standards, you can definitely tell the difference. There's not a lot of close-up photography. There is, however, a very famous close-up at the end of the film, which I guess we can talk about when we get there.
Spoiler alert.
It features some pretty remarkable stunt work.
I was going to... I was kind of thinking of different things that I liked and hated about the film.
Hmm.
And I found myself very much hard-pressed to actually kind of say anything bad about it, because this is very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, a lot of the action sequences are kind of the same kind of action sequences that you will see for the next 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
So I was quite impressed with that aspect of it.
Yeah, it definitely establishes a lot of motifs that will carry on throughout Westerns, especially the B-Westerns coming later, and the silent Westerns of Tom Mix and the others.
Mm-hmm.
The villains have hijacked the train. They go into the, what would the term be? The boxcar where the treasure is in transport. They kill a guard. They break into a safe. Some form of blanks being fired by the actors. A spectacular death scene where the clerk throws his hands to heaven and collapses in anguish.
This is a very violent film.
It is an exceptionally violent film, and that's something that I wanted to talk to you about it. Because this is before movies have any kind of a rating system. It's what is called pre-code days, mm-hmm. and there was no regulatory body. There was no interference from anybody, basically. Movies were shown mostly to the lower classes and to immigrants. They were the main original audiences for movies. And there was nobody policing what was in these movies other than the makers of the films themselves.
Yeah.
So they could pretty much get away with whatever they want. And this is one of the first times that people push the envelope in terms of violence, certainly.
Because I remember there's one scene, a guy gets thrown off the train.
He does, after being beaten over the head by a lump of coal.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell it's a dummy, but
still. You can.
Thrown off the train, man.
But it's definitely, it doesn't pull punches.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. Yeah, we'll go with that. Yeah, so they've killed the guard. They've tossed one of the engineers over the side of the moving train. Then they bring the train to a halt and rob all the passengers, which is also a remarkable scene because there's a lot of passengers on the train. Like, a lot of them. And there's only, like, 6 robbers, by my count. I don't know how many you came away with.
I did not make a count of it, I'm afraid.
It's definitely not more than 6.
Yeah.
And there's one guy covering about 20 extras. And rather than try to overpower their assailants, one guy decides to make a break for it. And he doesn't quite make it, I'm afraid.
He very famously gets shot.
He does. Like the unfortunate guardsman dies in rather a spectacular performance.
Yeah, I noticed that. Is this the way plays are being shown? Is this like the acting on stage, or is this a new type of acting?
So yeah, at this point in acting, Stanislavski, who's one of the major forces in developing a theory of acting, hasn't even published his seminal work yet. An Actor Prepares is not published till 1936 in English. Other than Aristotle and the like, there's not a lot of theory floating around beyond that. So I guess some early movie actors could have delved into some of that classical theory, but it seems more likely that they would be influenced by the other popular forms of entertainment of the day, like vaudeville was huge as an influence on cinema. Another interesting thing that I haven't mentioned yet about this Western is that it is actually not made in the West. It is made in Millstown, New Jersey, the headquarters of Edison's movie studio complex, the world's first movie studio, incidentally, closer to that East Coast theatrical style.
And vaudeville is very physical in many of the acts.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so that makes sense there.
Yeah, and I think the idea of stage acting still today, to this day, is more theatrical, if you will. So it makes sense that the performances would be more exaggerated than what we've come to be used to.
Right.
And I think by this point, films would have begun to be screened for groups. It was actually the Lumiere brothers who invented that technique of screening for more than one person at a time, and I'm sure Edison would have stolen it and implemented it by this time,
as opposed to the Nickelodeon, which was a kind of a one person, one machine.
Exactly. Yeah, if you can imagine such a thing, sort of like those 3D slide viewers,
the little viewfinders
from the 80s. Yeah,
the orange things that you put I love those things.
Those things are awesome.
The little paper slide that you put in?
Yeah. Those were very popular before movies, along with other magic lanterns and stuff, and that was sort of the ancestor of the Nickelodeon.
Okay.
But if you can imagine one of those attached to a giant machine.
Have you seen one?
Yes, actually, at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, they're quite big. Basically like arcade machines.
That makes sense. I imagine the arcade machines kind of get their design somewhat from the Nickelodeon.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that anyway. That's not like a historical fact. You don't want to give people the wrong idea, Chris says.
Why would there be historical facts on a podcast about pop culture history?
That's a good point. Anyway...
Yeah, so the movie is quite extraordinary. There is a chase scene, there is a dancing scene where some of the local townspeople are forcing someone to dance.
That was kind of the oddest part, in my opinion.
It does come out of left field.
Yeah.
There's very little preamble or explanation of who the good guys are. It's just kind of cut to them.
It's true. You have like this one guy who apparently finds the telegraph operator at the station, runs to the party, tells him that somebody robbed this train.
Right. After he's untied by his daughter.
And then it immediately cuts to them chasing the bad guys.
Yeah. So there's not very much explanation. I should mention there's no on-screen titles, which are a tradition of silent movies in this particular film. There's only an opening title and a closing.
That is, I didn't notice that, actually. That's a good point.
There's no dialogue spoken, in quotes, by the by titles on screen.
Right.
Or any kind of text. It's all pantomime. There's a gunfight.
Yeah, it's apparently the bad guys get away because they're actually divvying up the money.
Yep.
And then they're ambushed in the woods.
Yeah, presumably by the good guys that have been chasing them. Presumably, although that's not explicitly stated.
And this is one of the first films actually filmed on location. I remember reading that.
That's correct. This is very early in the development of on-location filming. Now, you've got to remember a lot of the documentary-type things. For example, the film we were talking about earlier, the French movie about the gardener.
Yeah, my French is just as good.
That film fireman. Would have been filmed
and on, his fireman,
in a garden. So not all movies were made
Porter's in a studio. Porter's other film, Life in America, that was filmed outside as well.
Yeah, outside and in the studio, which I think is the revolutionary aspect of that. The Great Train Robbery is a much more successful movie in terms of
that, sure.
Yeah, and definitely more academically analyzed. It establishes the Western, which I think America at this point is ready for the Western, for sure.
They had definitely been reading about it for quite a while, with Penny Dreadfuls and Nickel and Dime publications. And then, of course, the Wild West show.
And the Virginian, as you mentioned earlier.
And the Virginian in 1902. So definitely bringing the Western to the new technology.
So the pop culture is primed for it. At this point, in the early years of movie history, distribution systems are still very new. So at this time, Edison was selling copies of the movie to projectors or to Nickelodeons to screen. He wasn't renting prints, which became the standard practice in Hollywood right up until the end of film projection. And still to this day, when a film is screened physically, it's a rental, not an actual sale. This is definitely one of those films where the need for a model of distribution can be seen to be necessary, because it's such a popular film, it gets such a great response from the public, that there's a great deal of demand for it. But even with The Birth of a Nation 12 years later in 1915, there's not a lot of accurate data on how many copies of the film there were, or how many people saw the film, or how many tickets were sold, or how much money it made. A lot of that data is sadly lost to history, so we can't really be certain how much money The Great Train Robbery made, or how many people saw it, or how widespread its influence was, but we can infer that it was quite popular. Final point about the film itself that I have is the final shot.
The final shot is quite important.
The final shot of the movie is an actual close-up. Most of the other shots in the movie are quite wide, of one of the villains, presumably, played by Justice Barnes, I believe.
Who was an actual cowboy himself.
Drawing his weapon and pointing it directly at the camera and firing 6 shots. This has become a very iconic image in cinema.
In what way?
It's come to represent the Western as a genre. Some critics see it as a influence on the opening title sequence from the James Bond films. Martin Scorsese references it in his masterpiece Goodfellas, where one of the gangsters fires a sequence of shots directly at the camera. It's thought of as a symbol of the power of movies.
Interesting.
At the time, it was quite revolutionary to see a close-up at all.
Technologically, it was quite stunning.
Technologically quite stunning. I think a lot of the times that you don't see close-ups is because it hadn't occurred to anybody that that could be a useful tool that wouldn't be shocking in some way. To cut from a wider shot to a closer shot would have seemed daunting or strange. Or there's a lot of the grammar of cinema that we've become accustomed to. Cutting from a wide shot to a close-up is something that we've come to expect.
It was strange for me. I'm grew up watching like westerns of the 40s and the 60s and these later films, and it was kind of weird going back and seeing. I mean, it's 12 minutes long, so it's only so much you can fit in it, but it definitely didn't. It didn't watch like a normal western. So I noticed that also. From you said the grammar of cinema.
Mm-hmm. You mean it doesn't watch in terms of the pace, or what is the differences that you
like? There's not a lot of connection portions. Like we were talking about the dance, and then you're facing the bad guys. There's no explanation of like how did they find the bad guys? Where did they get their horses?
Right. Not a lot of transitional material.
Yeah. So it's just. It's the bare bones.
Yeah, but in some ways there's almost too much transitional material in other places, like where the girl's waking up the clerk, like
his presumably her father.
Yeah,
in the telegraph office. Yeah,
or the scene at the water tower takes quite a long time to play out, and there's really nothing happening there except the bad guys get on the train when the train stops.
Right.
Like it could have been just a couple seconds long, but it takes a lot longer than that.
Yeah, so it's, I guess they're experimenting with different lengths, trying to move the story along.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you, from your point of view, you latched onto some of the differences to later Westerns. I kind of latched onto all the similarities, just in terms of like the form of the chase and the outlaws and the robbery and costumes and, I mean...
Yeah, like... You said they were out in the East. The costumes are very much, you know, what you would expect from a later Western. Mm-hmm. They don't change. They don't change for another 20 years.
And not all that far removed from the actual days of the West themselves.
You're right. As we
primary period, quite a few people would still be alive.
I mentioned the actor who is in the last close-up. He was a cowboy. And a lot of these extras would have been around that time period as well.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of time periods, so things that are going on in the decade of 1900 to 1909, which is our first decade. This film was made in 1903 or released in 1903. The presidents of the United States at the time was President McKinley, who is shot in 1901. And then Teddy Roosevelt takes over until 1908. And to finish the decade off would be President Taft. There are 76,212,168 people or residents, according to the 1900 census, 45 states in the Union.
Which would have been an early census, right?
The 1900 the census actually is in the Constitution, so they've been collecting census information way, way back.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought it was more recent.
No, that was established for representation. But 1900 is one of the first times where they can actually calculate. They can actually calculate the numbers in like less than a couple of years. So because that's why it was 10 years every 10 years, because they needed all that time to calculate. So anyway, so over 76 million people or residents in the United States. Popular music of the day. Scott Joplin publishes The Entertainer in 1902. Mm. The Philippines War officially ended in 1902. So the Philippine War kind of comes out of the Spanish-American War, which starts in 1898. And
is that how the Philippines and the United States become initially connected?
Yeah, so the Philippines had been a Spanish colony since, of course, the very famous Spanish Empire. And during the Spanish-American War, that becomes an American possession. But the Filipinos want their independence, and the Americans are like, well, you're not ready yet. So there's a war in the Philippines that is really quite brutal on both sides. I had one college professor tell me it was kind of America's first Vietnam as far as controversy goes, and kind of that brutality, that level of brutality that you see when you associate with that conflict.
Not talked about a whole lot.
Not talked about at all, really. It's not one of the great shining moments as far as foreign
affairs. And who was president when that started?
When the war with Spain starts, that's McKinley.
Okay.
When the war in the Philippines ends, that's Roosevelt.
Gotcha. That ends
under Roosevelt's presidency. Orville and Wilbur Wright have their first controlled powered, sustained, heavier than air airplane at Kitty Hawk.
Yes, they do.
That's December 17th, 1903. So you said this film was released in December.
In December, so it would have been in the same month.
Same month. So is it older or younger than manned aircraft?
I would say the film is older because they would have had to have filmed it.
So this film is older than manned aircraft.
Before. Yes, it is.
Just think about that for a moment.
It's pretty staggering, the history of flight and how quickly we've become accustomed to the idea of getting into a machine and traveling somewhere in it through the air.
And that is true. Also interesting, the technology being developed in the early 20th century, of entertainment and in travel.
Yeah.
And of course, Henry Ford's company is incorporated in 1903.
Uh-huh.
Begins production of the Model T in 1908, which the Model T was America's most popular automobile.
Something Edison didn't really get into that much.
Which is interesting.
He's not really known for his efforts in the automobile world. I'm sure there were some, but they're not as well known.
But also in 1903, the first automobile trip across the United States from San Francisco to New York.
Oh, yeah.
Completed by Horatio Nelson Jackson and Sewell K. Crocker.
I'm pretty sure there's a movie about that.
That deserves a movie right there. The news, www.history.com, also had an article on that. It's in our notes, anyway. The first teddy bear introduced to the United States in 1903.
The teddy bear wouldn't be related to Teddy Roosevelt at all, would it?
It might, yes. According to the story, Teddy Roosevelt was hunting. If I recall this, supposedly the story goes is that Teddy Roosevelt was out hunting. He's a very, you know, he's an outdoorsy kind of a guy, likes the outdoors, likes to hunt.
Yes.
And apparently his guides pull out this bear on a rope and kind of like tie him up or leave him out there. He's kind of apparently an old bear.
Uh-huh.
And Teddy Roosevelt refuses to shoot him. It's not sporting enough.
Yeah.
And of course the media get a hold of it and they start calling these little bears as a teddy bear. And so they make him a toy, producing a little stuffed bear and calling him Teddy.
That's awesome.
So
while Edison is electrocuting elephants, Teddy is sparing the bears.
Sparing the bear. North Carolina becomes the first state to require registration for nurses in 1903. A little medical history there. In 1903, the American League Baltimore team, this is baseball, is purchased for $18,000, moved to New York, and is renamed the Highlanders. This will eventually become the New York Yankees. So,
oh man,
this film could be older than the Yankees, if you think about it.
A dynasty begins.
Also, Harry Houdini is quite the entertainer. He is touring in Europe in 1903.
Wow, so he would have been a contemporary of Melies.
A little bit later on, the U.S. Mint introduces the first Lincoln head penny in 1909.
Oh, wow.
And of course, we're talking about film history. The first Academy Award won't be till 1929.
That is true.
There is no awards for early film either.
So no. There,
that's what's going on in our first decade. In our first Western.
In the American world at large. Do you think Teddy Roosevelt's kind of rough and ready persona played a lot into the early popularity of the Western? You think that, that you see a connection between?
Yeah, that is a good thought, because Teddy Roosevelt did go out west in that Gilded Age. He was a New Yorker by birth,
mm-hmm.
and after his first wife passes away, he moves to I think South Dakota, where he has a big old ranch out there, and he holds a lot of different jobs. I think he was a bounty hunter, or he would refer to himself kind of in that kind of same mold. He was a hunter. He really liked the West a lot, and he kind of puts that out there when he's president. He's actually one of the first modern presidents in terms of media usage. He's, I think, the first president to actually have a press corps come into the White House.
Oh, wow.
And he gives like these news updates, you know, type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely uses his image to his advantage as president. So
definitely a guy who's media savvy.
Yeah.
In terms of the new media that was happening then, but also very aware of America's mythology.
Yeah. So all of that kind of plays a part into what's going on
in the movies. Yeah. Well, I think that kind of concludes what we have to talk about.
Our last part of it, homework. we talked about having a third portion of the show called homework. And
because homework is oh so fun.
Yeah. Talk about it being like a challenge or something like that, or just the reading suggestions.
Yeah.
I was thinking in terms of me challenging you, but actually listening to you talk has made me interested in a couple of points, particularly Thomas Edison himself. I'm shocked at my own ignorance in his life.
I am, but too, at my own, not at yours.
Thank you for clearing that up.
And also, more specifically for me, I am challenged to learn more about the Lumiere brothers.
Yeah.
Because in my research for this podcast, I was very fascinated by them. They are kind of the founding fathers of cinema, up there with Edison and with Méliès and with the others who pioneered the art form. But I know very little about them.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to watch more of their films and learn about them more.
Yeah, so did you come across any books about the Lumières or about Edison in your research that I could browse?
None that I can recommend at this point.
Fair enough. Okay.
For those of you listening at home, we would love to have your participation in this monkey circus that we call our podcast. You can send us a email at popstorian@gmail.com.
We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Oh, yes. And you can find us at Popstorian on both those sites.
So please give us a like on Facebook if you enjoy the show. Give us a follow on Twitter. Subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, whether that's Stitcher or iTunes or whatever you're using. Give us a review. Let everyone know if you like the show. And definitely drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you and maybe feature some of your emails on the show.
That would be cool.
Also, if you're watching these movies along with us, we would love to hear what you think about them. If you have thoughts about the Great Train Robbery or about early 1900s American history, drop us your thoughts. popstorian@gmail.com, or Facebook message, or direct message on Twitter. We're out there. We're real.
Thanks for listening to the Popstorian podcast. Be sure to subscribe. You can find us online at popstorian.com or on Facebook and Twitter. Tune in next time for more of the history of popular culture.
Well, Chris, I think we completed our first episode.
I think we did.